Today, very little preamble. In this episode, we're meeting one of the insect world's most famous ambassadors, the monarch butterfly, a pretty and sizable orange butterfly that absolutely loves to go travelling. In this episode, you're going to get the details you need if you want to count the monarch butterfly, involve yourself with all things monarch, and help out with their conservation. Granted, that's only true if you live in a very specific part of the world. So, if you're in Los Angeles or somewhere near there, good news, it's monarch time. Park your Chevrolet, engage with the monarch. If you're not from Los Angeles, no worries. You're still going to get to find out some amazing things about monarch butterflies, its relationship with the milkweed plant, other plants, its journey, its lifestyle, and so much more. I've got to go downstairs now and tend to something. So that's basically it from me. Luckily, you don't need much more from me because soon you'll get to hear from Richard Rachman, a fantastic scientist who's passionate about the monarch butterfly and is primed to educate you, as he educated me. So let's get into it as we discover the monarch butterfly with Richard Rachman. So today I'm thrilled to be joined by plant ecologist and Western Monarch Count Los Angeles County Coordinator, Richard Rachman. Richard, how are you today?
Hi, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. I'm looking forward to talking about the monarch and about the count and all things monarch. But before we do that, we were having a little chat beforehand, and I feel like your relationship with invertebrates and with animals is quite an interesting one, being a plant ecologist. And so I was wondering, could you just describe for us, how would you describe your relationship with the natural world in general?
So I've been obsessed with animals since I was a little kid, watching Steve Irwin, Crocodile Hunter. Getting into plants is kind of recent for me. And my whole life, I was just kind of consuming information about animals and animal facts and knowing I wanted to be a zookeeper, zoologist or something. One of my first research experiences in undergrad was with scorpions and harvestmen. A lot of them fluoresce and UV light, and they're really fun to go hunt and stuff like that. So I was out in the desert, you know, hunting scorpions and making little undergraduate research projects out of it. It was really fun. Then someone converted me to plants, and we got a grant to do plant research, tree rings. And I just fell in love. There's a lot of them. They're easy to study. Well, all reasons to study insects too, right? There's a lot of them.
Sure.
It's hard to find mammals. Yeah, yeah. It's hard to find fish and birds. But insects and plants are everywhere. So that appealed to me. And then eventually, I guess this is getting right into like, why do I study monarchs? Someone from the San Diego Zoo was talking to one of my colleagues in Los Angeles about needing a Los Angeles County coordinator for the monarch count. And at that point, I was doing my master's degree at Cal State Northridge in Northern Los Angeles. And for anyone that doesn't know, that's in Southern California. But I guess it's on TV a lot, so that helps.
Richard, at this point, is teasing me slightly because before we started the call, I was very impressed that he was from Los Angeles because, as I explained, it's the place from TV, place from films.
I was involved in a lot of advocacy groups for native plants. I was involved with the Audubon Society for Birds. And so someone told someone else, I was involved in a lot of advocacy groups for native plants. I was involved with the Audubon Society for Birds. And so someone told someone else, like, hey, there's this guy, Richard, he does a lot of volunteering. You should like reach out and find out if he'd be interested. When I get asked, I'm thinking like, well, I like milkweed a lot and I study milkweed quite often. I guess I can, you know, get into monarchs. And I just hit the ground running and learned as much as I could, as fast as I can. So now I've been doing it for 3 years. And
so your way to the monarch then is through milkweed, being someone who studies plants. So to skip ahead, milkweed is the food of the monarch butterfly, right?
Yeah, so there's a few members of the kind of dogbane milkweed family that monarchs will go after, and it varies across the world, as the monarch has a pretty wide distribution from New Zealand and Australia, non-natively in Hawaii, probably in Australia too, and then of course in like United States, down into Mexico, and then there's some populations as well in South America. So they go after the family of milkweed plants, Is it Apocyanaceae? Oh my gosh, now I'm like on the spot for my plant taxonomy. But so there's a few members of different genera that of those plants that the monarch will, the larva will feed on. In the United States specifically, it's the genus Asclepias, which is milkweed. There's a few other members of other, like Funastrum, they might go after that a little bit. That's twining milkweed. Probably not that much. There's some suggestion they might eat dogbane, Apocynum, but probably not. Mostly it's Asclepias, so it's milkweed. So if we were to hypothetically lose all the milkweed in the contiguous United States, the monarch butterfly would disappear. That's pretty well assured. So, but milkweed's cool because it doesn't just attract monarch butterflies. It attracts all these other types of insects, aphids, parasitoidal wasps, tarantula hawks, which I don't know if you've ever heard of or seen. You probably. Yeah. They're super cool. Like, and they nectar feed on milkweed, and it's super cool to watch them. These giant, terrifying wasps, like, swarm around it, and you're just like, oh my gosh. They have a really powerful sting, so it's good to be respectful of them and keep distance. But they're cool to photograph when they're feeding on milkweed. So if we protect monarchs and we protect milkweed, this plant that their larvae need to eat in order to survive, we protect all these other insects too. It's just such a neat system.
Yeah. I'm sensing the answer in part to what I'm about to ask you, but you just said you like milkweed, and I'm familiar with what it means to like insects and animals and invertebrates, and all the crossover that exists there between those terms. And I've had the pleasure of talking with lots of people who are enthusiastic about different animals, different invertebrate animals. Less often have I talked to someone who's enthusiastic about a plant, which is not to say that I'm sceptical of such a thing. Plants are lovely. We love plants. Fab. But I'm interested to know, as a well-informed person, as someone who studies plants, what makes you like a plant? What about a plant sparks enthusiasm in a person?
There's a ton of them. They're really easy to find and to look at. There's a ton of different types. So all really, like, insects and plants, like, there's a lot of, from a academic or even like a teaching pedagogical perspective, there's a lot of similarities. There's a lot of really interesting evolutionary history going on. There's, it's like Pokemon. There's like always a new one to discover and a new one to see and learn about. And also plants have just been used by people for thousands of years. And so when I'm teaching people about plants, like, that's usually the information that they're most interested in. Like, how can I benefit from this? And so I love teaching folks about that often, of like, especially with more so invasive plants. I don't really want people harvesting or foraging for native plants as often, but I really love teaching people about herbalism surrounding non-native plants. It's always really fun. But what I think your listeners would be most interested in, they already know, is insects need plants. They need it for habitat, they need it for foraging, they need it for for attracting their prey, for the leaf material, the nectar, the pollen. They need plants. And often we find there's a direct correlation between specific types of plants and specific types of insects. Oak trees will have a gall producing wasp associated with that. And that wasp, gall producing wasp, will have a specific parasitoidal wasp associated with it. And then so now you have these three species that, if one of those things didn't exist, the other two would cease to exist. Or whatever. I'm just saying, so like, there's a chain, right? I'm sure the oak doesn't need the parasitoidal wasp, but like, maybe in some far off kind of way. But the plant insect connection is so strong for so many different plants. And monarchs are an example of that, right? So we have this insect that lays eggs on milkweed. The larvae hatch after a few days, maybe depending on the temperature. And then you have the larvae that develops on that patch of milkweed for a few weeks, and it consumes the leaves of the milkweed because it has carotenoids, cardiac glycosides. And the cardiac glycosides are this toxic compound to most mammals and birds, right? That if we eat it, we get sick. And so the monarch has developed metabolic pathways in order to imbue itself with this toxin and protect itself. So without this toxin in this plant, the monarch wouldn't be as successful as it is. Now, not all populations are successful. The Western monarch's not doing great. But generally, it's a really cool story of coevolution in which these plants are very toxic and as an anti-herbivory response. And this animal has evolved to live amongst that anti-herbivory response. And so many milkweed populations have intensified the amount of cardiac glycosides they have in them. And as a response, the monarch have developed an insatiable taste for these toxins. And so it's kind of this like arms race that's going on. And some milkweeds have more cardiac glycosides than others. One example is like the tropical milkweed, which is an invasive species. And that might be a kind of sticky situation for the monarch because it has so much of these cardiac glycosides that the monarch kind of prefers it, like kind of like crack cocaine. It very much goes towards tropical milkweed, but that could put them at an evolutionary disadvantage in the future. As climate change gets worse and worse, milkweed is going to have stronger and stronger cardiac glycosides as a response to climate change. And there's going to be a point at which monarchs won't be able to handle that much of the toxin compared to the rate at which the plant is producing it. So it's a tricky situation. And also just invasive plants in general are bad. They like outcompete native plants. They often cause some sort of harm economically, culturally, to communities of people that live by them. And then tropical milkweed also has a different phenology than most of the other milkweeds. So it doesn't die back as much during the winter time as other native milkweeds do. And so it more often is a reservoir for parasites that may harm monarch butterflies. And yeah, I kind of mentioned that briefly in some of our earlier conversations. One of the parasites that's of most concern is OE, which is a protozoan that affects dispersal. So again, plants, everyone should be studying plants. Everyone should be learning plants. They're super cool, especially if you like insects.
So when we talk about eating leaves, presumably we're talking about the caterpillar of the monarch, which is, it is the monarch, but it's that kind of confusing thing with butterflies and with a lot of insects where it's the same animal, we have different terminology for its different life stages, which makes it sound like we're talking about different creatures. But when we talk about eating leaves, we're talking about the caterpillar that eats the leaves, right? And therefore it's the caterpillar that's making itself toxic.
The monarch, the adult stage is toxic as well. I was doing an interview with the LA Times at a golf course studying, like when I was collecting monarch butterfly data, and we were just watching a Cassin's kingbird, Tyrannidae, I think. Tyrant. It's a bird. And it was just like going after overwintering monarchs. Like it would fly, catch one, go back to its perch, and then it would chew on it and then it'd spit it out. And then just kept doing it over and over and over again, like trying to eat the butterfly and then throwing up, trying to eat a butterfly and then throwing up. And it was like, what are you trying to are you trying to rapidly evolve to like this butterfly? Like you're going to throw up every time. There are rodents and there are some birds that have evolved metabolic pathways to deal with cardiac glycosides. So they will eat overwintering monarchs at overwintering sites. It's really fascinating. Not a lot of animals can deal with it, and it makes them throw up. So, yeah.
So is the adult somehow having these toxins carried through the life cycle then, or is the adult also feeding on the milkweed and imbuing itself with those toxins?
No, they don't. So the adult, so caterpillars go through four or five instars pretty quickly, and then a few weeks later they develop turn their chrysalis, and then a few weeks go by, they eclose, I believe that's the etymological term. I hope I'm using it correctly. And then eclosed? Yeah, whatever. And then they're an adult, right? And so here's the funky thing. So the adults, to answer that question, the adults will nectar feed mostly on Asteraceae, sunflowers, daisies, those sorts of things. Anything with like kind of that large launch pad. So flowers have these things called syndromes. Syndromes are specific colors, specific shapes, specific patterns that attract what insect is going to best pollinate that plant. Or they go for a generalist thing and they just want any insect that flies by. Sometimes it smells like rancid flesh, which is like attracting flies. Sometimes it's big and yellow with a launch pad, and that's for big butterflies. Often. And so often flowers with these launch pads are really good for monarchs. And so now here's the confusing thing. So monarchs have like 4 to 6 generations per year, depending on where they live. The Western monarch, the one that does the migration from the Rocky Mountains to California, essentially. Sometimes they stay in like the inland California. Sometimes they'll go to Nevada and Arizona, whatever. But the generation that overwinters in California, they have about 4 to 6 generations per year. And it's that last generation, the 5th generation or the 6th generation, that lives like 6 months. It lives like a really long time. All the other generations only live like a few months. And then they die, they reproduce and then die. They live a few more, the next generation lives a few months, reproduces, dies. And then, but that last generation, the one that makes its flight all the way across the United States, they're going to live a really long time. They live the entire winter, essentially, just clustering on these trees. And they're going to nectar feed on these sunflowers during the daytime, like when temperatures are a little warmer, and then at night they cluster on the branches to conserve energy.
If you're enjoying Grubbing in the Filth, come and wallow with me in the horrendous world of social media. You can follow Grubbing in the Filth on Instagram and Twitter. On Instagram it's @grubbinginthefilth, and on Twitter it's @GITFpodcast. You can also email grubbinginthefilth@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you, whether it's your own perspective, to share a story, a photo, or what have you. Maybe at this point it would be good for me to tell you what I already know about the monarch, because the monarch's one of those butterflies that it's relatively well known because of this migratory pattern and its code on TV shows and things. And what I know about it, I think, is probably roughly in line with what many people know about the monarch. So I'll give you my sense of it, and then maybe you can sort of fill in some gaps for us. So the monarch is an orange butterfly, pretty butterfly, with nice black Venetian patterns on its wings, and it's a migratory butterfly. And the one that I'm more aware of is the eastern monarch, which is the one that goes from Canada down to Mexico on this sort of well-documented flight. Is that right, give or take?
Yeah, it's like Canada, North, the Great Plains. Like, it depends where the last generation ends up. But yeah, it goes the eastern seaboard down to central Mexico, to like a very specific area in central Mexico.
So then I'm assuming the reason the butterfly has its migration is to do with the weather, right? So it's in somewhere fleeing the cold, going somewhere warm, and then when the weather changes again, it's going back. Is that correct?
Well, what if I challenge you and say it's all about plants?
Oh, okay. So the monarch isn't pursuing the warm weather, it's pursuing the plants are thriving in the warm weather, right?
Right, because what is to stop an insect from just laying an egg or being in some sort of chrysalis or cocoon to outlast winter? That's what most insects do, right? Or they like burrow, they go under bark, or like they go underground. Or there's a ton of ways that you can deal with diapause, right? But you can deal with like the winter period, but if your food larval food source is milkweed, and it is this perennial plant that strongly dies back in the winter, right? If you're in the way you dealt with the cardiac glycosides is to be of larger size, to have like a stronger anti-predatory response to your bright colors, migration makes a lot of sense. And being larger is easier to migrate really long distances. There are a lot of other lepidopterans that do migrations. Like, I think lineated sphinx moths do like a pretty big migration that we're still learning a lot about. But so there are other insects that travel far distances, but they're pretty big. And so this big size, this toxin that they're dealing with, it lends itself to migrating. But I think there's pretty okay evidence that the plant has a lot to do with their migration as well. Maybe it's just my hypothesis, but milkweed dies back. They need milkweed. And then we lose milkweed in the winter because it's died back. And so they do this migration to Central Mexico. There's no milkweed in Central Mexico. What they're doing is they're waiting it out with optimal temperatures. They're waiting the whole winter period. And then as soon as it's done, then they go lay their eggs as close by as possible with sperm that they've saved during the winter period. So some of the females might eat some of the sperm during the sperm packets during the winter period as well. But it's known as sexual diapause, this 4 to 5, 6 month period where they're clustering. And then as soon as that period is over, they'll immediately mate, or they've already mated during the sexual diapause, which is, it happens. And then they'll just lay eggs as soon as possible and die right after. So, okay, that was all to address that question of like, why are they, you know, migrating? I think it's because of milkweed, but you know, whatever.
Sure, but then you're mentioning that that's the eastern monarch, right? So your western monarch has a different route. So I'm presuming same principle, but a different warm place to overwinter.
Totally. And so eastern monarch and western monarch are the same species. The Funk Lab at Colorado State University is looking at some of the genomics of Western monarchs and Eastern monarchs, as well as residential monarchs that don't migrate at all, which we can talk a little bit about that as well. But the Western monarch is just behaviorally different. It's not genetically that unique compared to the Eastern monarch. So monarchs overwinter in warmer places. They do this kind of all over the world where they're found. Often, if they're in places like South America or, you know, parts of Southern Australia, they might not have to do it as dramatically. But if they're in a colder part of Australia or New Zealand, they definitely do a migration to warmer parts of the coast to hang out during whatever, you know, that location's winter period is. In California, in the Western monarch, what happens is, so the last generation of monarchs may be in the desert in California, they may be in Montana, Idaho, Oregon, they may be in Colorado. It depends, right? Wherever that last generation is, they then, when the fall season starting October, like maybe even September, they start flying. They start flying all the way to California along the coast of California, and they spend their entire October, November, December, January. January, February is generally when they start to either lay their eggs and die off, or and then maybe March, but like it's generally around that period, like January, February, where they lay their eggs. But that whole time, so they're sleeping on these branches during the nighttime, they warm up around 55 degrees Fahrenheit. Oh my gosh, what is that Celsius? I'm such a bad scientist. so 13 centigrade. And then once it gets to about 65, a few degrees higher than that centigrade, so it'd be 65 Fahrenheit. Then they're like flying. And then that's when they're like nectar feeding for the day. So there's some days where it doesn't get above 55 on the coast of California. So the monarchs will just stay clustered on the branches. Now the Western monarch's distribution during this overwintering period for its last generation, it's the geographic distribution is kind of shaped like a bell curve. So if you look at the state of California up by San Francisco and the Bay Area, it's kind of the low end of the bell curve. There's not a lot of overwintering monarchs there. But if you go more towards Monterey, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, Ventura County, that's where you get seeing this peak of Western monarchs that are clustering on these trees. And it looks like it's in like central Mexico. They are covered, the branches are covered in monarchs that are clustering together, like thousands upon thousands of monarchs together. Some people say they look like they're dripping from the trees, because sometimes a gust of wind will come and they'll just like kind of like all shimmer off and the sky will just be like filled with them. It's really magical. Where the bell curve starts teetering off is like Los Angeles County, Orange County. So where Anaheim is in Orange County, and then down to San Diego, and then they do even get into Baja California. There's also some overwintering monarchs that spend the winter on a plant called creosote in Death Valley, California, which is a Death Valley National Park. They hang out in these saline kind of like riparian corridors that are, I think it's called Saline Valley in Death Valley. But these riparian corridors that have been washed out from water that goes down the creeks and then cuts like really dramatic canyons in this desert landscape. And the monarchs will cluster on these desert plants. And it's so far away from the coast. But those are some funky populations. There's a lot of people that are really interested in studying them. Not too many people know what's going on with that situation. But that's been used for thousands of years as an overwintering site too. But most of the time, it's very close to the coast. So typically, it's within right on the coast, or like maybe a mile or two in the coast. Some of the Los Angeles County sites are maybe about 20 miles away from the coast. That's pretty weird. But most of the time, and they're using native and non-native trees. California has been colonized by white people since about the 1600s, first with the Spaniards. And then a lot of like Eastern white Americans came over as a lot of really horrendous genocide that happened with indigenous people. But there's still a very strong indigenous presence in California. We have some of the largest numbers of indigenous groups in California, in the whole United States. It's a huge diversity of cultures. And a lot of this monarch science is, you know, led by indigenous people too. So really cool stuff. But so these sites often correspond with really important indigenous villages too in Los Angeles. So there's a site by kind of central California or central Los Angeles County that was an indigenous Tongva village, had a lot of sycamores, and monarchs were known to cluster in those sites. Malibu has a lot of these kind of like sycamore canyons, Western sycamores with indigenous Chumash villages that were there, and monarchs are still clustering around those areas. So there's this like really storied connection between people and monarchs that's been going on in California for a very long time. And there's a lot of like Day of the Dead celebrations incorporating monarchs in central Mexico. So monarchs are very important to indigenous people all across the world, right? But in California, post-colonization, and the introduction of eucalyptus from Australia, this large tree that they initially thought was going to be really good for the railroad in California as like a building material and a timber industry, it totally failed. And it's this really terrible invasive plant that has spread in cities like San Diego and Santa Barbara, and I would argue in parts of LA as well, in Malibu. I don't like it. It's a pretty gross plant. It smells weird. It also it burns on fire quite easily and arguably promotes wildfire. And so it's a very non-natural thing on the landscape in Southern California. When some of the Spanish colonizers were arriving in Southern California, they would describe hills of almost no trees, these large coastal plains of maybe low-lying shrubs and wildflowers for miles and miles and miles, as well as like indigenous villages and stuff. But there's not a lot of trees. Monarchs will use shrubs to overwinter on. Monarchs will use oak trees, they'll use sycamores, but often in these like canyons that are protected from the wind. In the modern context, we've put trees everywhere in Southern California. And we've put trees, and they're important for urbanization. Trees are really important for keeping temperatures down, and they have a lot of ecosystem services, but they're very new on the landscape, particularly eucalyptus, right? Which are extremely important for monarch butterflies. So as much as a plant ecologist, I'm like, ew, eucalyptus. As someone that's really into monarchs, I'm like, no, eucalyptus are super important. We need to take care of them in these specific areas. Right. If a eucalyptus is a grove is has trees dying or is becoming a threat or whatever, often what conservationists will do now is we'll plant native plants that monarch butterflies will use in that grove instead of planting eucalyptus. So while we caution people against cutting down eucalyptus, they shouldn't do that. Or just, you know, if they do remove branches, do it outside the overwintering period. And Circe's Society has a lot of like details on how to take care of overwintering sites. Instead of planting more eucalyptus, we should be planting native plants that monarchs will be using. And there's been research done that shows monarchs do not have a preference for native or non-native trees. Like, they'll use both of them. I've seen monarchs use California native pine trees. I've seen them use shrubs. I've seen them use willows and sycamores and oak trees. Like, they don't really have a preference. They just need to meet some standards of blocking wind, being directly correctly oriented towards the sun, the early morning sun, so they can wake up correctly. And then the right amount of leaf material for them to protect themselves. So there's some like wind dynamics that are going on for tree preference. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff with trees, I think, that's really understudied and interesting with monarchs. There's someone out, I think Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz, that's going to be doing some remote sensing using drones and LIDAR. So that's lasers that shoot down from the drones to map out the overwintering sites, as well as using wind sensors to kind of figure out what is wind doing in these overwintering sites. And then what is the leaf canopy coverage in these sites? So we can kind of characterize and protect monarch overwintering habitat the best that we can. I'm super excited about that interface between drones and remote sensing and insect conservation. So that's super exciting research. I'm excited to see the results of.
You can now make donations to help offset the running costs of this podcast. If you're enjoying Grubbing the Filth and want to make a donation, like a benevolent Victorian, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/grubbingcast. Or you can also write a brief message if you so wish. Any donations are truly appreciated. Thank you. It's really exciting to think about this idea the monarch has a history alongside people, that people have been connected to the monarch through its presence, maybe its transitory presence, in the places that they live. And it's exciting to me because insects, whilst largely present in our lives, are not particularly apparent to us, but the monarch, its comings and goings have been viewed as events, right? And something to be experienced. So I want to ask you, what is it actually like to experience the monarch migration? Because we're talking about what it does and we're talking about the things it's up to, but what I'd love to know is what it's like to actually, as an individual, experience the monarch.
One of the coolest things was when I was starting this and I went with my binoculars, sunrise. It's about 54 degrees Fahrenheit, 13 degrees centigrade. And so it's kind of chilly. It was close to the ocean, so it's pretty, there's a lot of marine layer, a lot of fog. And you walk up and you look into the branches of these trees. You're like walking through a little forest, right? And you look up and it's kind of hard to see them at first. Like, they kind of look like leaves. There's a chip that's really popular here. Doritos, their tortilla chip, they kind of look like dull Doritos. They don't move when it's really cool. And suddenly a gust of wind happened, and like, just like I said, like, they puffed out and like they fluttered a little across to another tree. Chills all around my body, just like completely And there's sites that are much better than LA County. Like, there's sites in Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo that have thousands and thousands of monarchs. But just for me to see hundreds was such an awe-inspiring moment that I was like, oh, this is a cool, you know, this is a cool gig I got myself involved in.
And when they do move,
I'll talk about, so this summer in Boise, Idaho, I'm in Boise, Idaho for my PhD. Idaho is in northern United States. It's mostly Great Basin sagebrush kind of ecosystem. It's a cold desert. I guess like a similar kind of place would be like some of the Asian steppes or like Mongolia with some of the shrublands there. Maybe northern Scotland, kind of like shrubland cold. But so I'm in this new place. I'm floating on the river, the Boise River. It's an urban river that flows right through the city. And every summer, everyone loves getting on, you know, like inflatable devices and kind of floating down. Right. It's just a giant party. It's really, really fun. And so I'm floating down the river with some friends. And I look up and I see a monarch butterfly racing up the river. It was same kind of experience, like goosebumps all over my body. Just really electric feeling seeing this monarch racing. And I was scouring iNaturalist, which is a community science app that I use a lot, and I teach people about it quite often. I was scouring iNaturalist all year in Boise, Idaho, to look for evidence of monarch butterflies and when they would come. And I saw a few locations in Idaho that they were using. There's a few, maybe one site in Boise that they were using, maybe one or two. But the monarchs were using very specific areas in Idaho. And these same butterflies are then going to return, that last generation, to California, flying hundreds of miles to the coast of California to spend the rest of the winter. So, you know, you could do the tourist thing and you could fly to, you know, Santa Barbara or Los Angeles Airport, and then go find an overwintering site. On our website, westernmonarchcount.org, there's a map where you can find the sites. It's all publicly available data. We don't try to hide anything. We believe these sites should be monitored by people and easy to find. So you can travel to one of our overwintering sites, and you can help with the count yourself. So that's one way you could experience monarchs. Another is, if you live in the Western United States, plant milkweed.
Right.
We suggest people not plant milkweed if they live close to an overwintering site, because milkweed will trigger monarchs to exit sexual diapause, and it'll make them fight. It'll make them mate. And those all use fat reserves that are better spent for the overwintering period surviving the winter. So we suggest people plant milkweed away from overwintering sites, and you'll attract monarch butterflies. You'll have larvae on your plants eating the milkweed, and they'll develop into monarchs. And a lot of them will die. That's fine. A lot of them will be parasitized. A lot of them will be, you know, birds might try to eat them or whatever. A lot of them will have like, what's that fly? There's like a fly that like will lay eggs on monarchs. There's a bunch of parasites that'll attack monarch butterflies. I think it's all fine. Like, yeah, people need to stop trying to rear them. Yeah, it's all big picture. People need to stop rearing monarchs and like trying to save them in like very controlled settings with like nets and with enclosures. And so it's all very bizarre. People think they're helping by raising this really threatened species, but they need to let just nature take its course. Let predation happen. It's cruel. And I don't want to commit the nature fallacy that if it's natural, it's fine. Mm-hmm. But it is. This is how evolution moves forward, is by predator-prey relationships. And if we were to, you know, interrupt that, we could be interrupting the migration. We could be interrupting parasite loads, that your captive monarchs might be more susceptible to higher parasite loads or contract diseases or give diseases to other monarchs. So just stay out of it. Plant milkweed, plant native plants, and experience it in your backyard, but don't get involved other than, you know, planting these plants that attract them.
Well, speaking of parasites, I know one thing about the monarch, which is this shadowy and malicious presence, although probably shouldn't say that because this is just nature. It's what's up. But OE, this something. Can you tell me what exactly is OE?
Yeah, so OE is I'm not even going to attempt to say the scientific name. It's a protozoan that is found on especially residential monarchs. So these are monarchs that live in an area all year round. There's some places in Texas, some places in Florida, Hawaii, now in Southern California and the Bay Area. These monarchs hang out in the city. They don't migrate. They don't need to. There's food for them all year round, and they just hang out in these places. And often they have very high parasite loads of OE. This protozoan, very small. You can take a piece of tape and tape it on their abdomen and then put it on a slide in order to detect it. But they've found that monarchs with OE are very bad at dispersal and will often die in migration. So in monarchs that migrate to these areas where there's residential populations will often get higher chance of being infected by OE. And OE has also been found more often on non-native milkweed, the tropical milkweed. And so when this milkweed doesn't die back during the winter time and people don't cut it back, they should cut it back. They should not even plant it. They should just get rid of it. But when this tropical milkweed is around, OE is more present on that plant during the wintering period. And has when monarchs then lay their eggs on that non-native plant, it has a higher chance of being infected in the caterpillar stage and then infected as an adult, where they can then spread the OE to other adults as well. So it's nasty. If people just plant native plants, native milkweed as well, there's still a chance that the OE could, you know, be persistent on that milkweed. I've actually looked at data from iNaturalist of native milkweed in urban areas in California, and it sticks around during the winter period. They're popular, kind of what people are saying around native plants is that, oh, well, the native milkweed, it dies back completely in the winter, which is different than the non-native one. I have evidence that's not true, that even the native milkweed will persist in urban, especially in urban areas with urban, think about urban heat island effects where urban areas are hotter than non-urban areas. And then also think about how much water there is in urban areas because of lawns, artificial irrigation, just people in general, like using tons of water. So plants themselves have different phenologies in urban areas. And so even native milkweed is persisting vegetatively longer in the winter period. Monarchs are using native milkweeds in the winter period when they should be in sexual diapause. They are using it. And so even native milkweeds are becoming a reservoir for OE, this protozoan parasite that diminishes dispersal ability. It's really nasty. I don't know. I think we need to study it more. And there's a lot of people that are studying it. There's this Monarch Science blog that I follow that I really love a lot from a professor at University of Georgia. He has a lot of really interesting articles about OE. So if people want to learn more, I highly recommend checking out the Monarch Science blog.
Well, what I think we should talk about now is actually about the count, because we have not really mentioned it. So let's talk more about the monarch count. What is it? Why is it? And what can people do if they want to get involved in it?
Yeah, so you sign up to volunteer. Your email address eventually gets sent to me, and I coordinate with volunteers all across Los Angeles County to figure out, okay, what site are you going to adopt and then go visit? So when the count actually happens, after they plan where they're going to park and how they're going to walk to the site, is they get there around sunrise. They have to make sure that the temperature is around that 13 degrees centigrade that we talked about. Because once it gets hotter, the butterflies start flying and you can't really count them when they start flying. It's best to count them when they're clustered so you can get really good counts and estimates of how many are there. So you take your binoculars, you have an app on your phone or you use a paper sheet. You collect the data of how many are there, what direction the wind is going, how fast the wind is moving, what the temperature is, how many clouds there are. We collect data on how big the clusters are, what is the spatial arrangement of the clusters in comparison to the trees. What tree species are they clustering on? Are there nectaring plants close by, like something called mule fat they use often, or like a California brittle bush. What are the plants that they might be feeding on close by? And then what are some disturbances to the area? Is there evidence that they're using herbicides in the area or some sort of insecticide? Is there evidence that they're cutting down trees? We found a really nasty case this year of people cutting down eucalyptus, which, again, it's a plant that's non-native, and like branches fall when temperatures get too cold. So it's kind of dangerous in urban areas. So I get the impulse to cut and trim the trees down. But at the same time, like if you trim them at the wrong time, the monarchs will just leave and not use that site. And if they leave an overwintering site, they often die. So volunteers collect this data, threats, as well as like just numbers of monarchs and stuff like that. They report it on the app, and then we collect it. Xerces Society collects it, and then we report it. And so the Thanksgiving count, which just wrapped up today was the last day for the Thanksgiving count. We're going to release that data internationally in January. And then the New Year's count, which is coming up, is going to start. Oh, I just sent you the dates. I think I said the 17th. No. It's like the day after Christmas, isn't it? Like the 26th. That's what it is. And then that's going to go into January. I think two weeks around New Year's, essentially. So the New Year's count. So if people want to get involved and volunteer, you use the westernmonarchcount.org website, find out where the overwintering sites are and whether or not you want to drive there. Driving in Los Angeles is kind of a nightmare. So a lot of other communities, like everything's basically 20-minute drive away. In Los Angeles, like just to get a few miles might take you an hour. So if someone lives in Pasadena and doesn't want to commute an hour and a half to Santa Monica, I get it. To go look at some butterflies. It's a lot. So we hope that people, adopt sites that are like geographically close to them so that you have a connection to them. So if someone's disturbing the habitat or cutting down trees, it's an issue that is close to your heart, close to your neighborhood. And you know, it has the potential, it is a social justice issue, especially in like areas like South LA, where the majority of the population are not white people, right? Latino people, black folks. And so these overwintering monarch habitat, it's nature. Urban nature is nature, like period. And so these communities that often are less funded by the city of LA and LA County, where they're being marginalized by environmental racism, these overwintering habitats are nature. So if we can protect them and we can get folks interested in conserving them, this makes more green spaces in areas where green spaces are limited. There's not a lot of parks in South LA. And so protecting these areas is even more important to show these communities what nature looks like in their own backyard. And so versus in areas like Malibu and Santa Monica, where the median household income is like, what, $150,000 a year. They're fine.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
But it's still really important we protect those. Yeah, it's important we protect those habitats as well. I would just say there's less of a social justice issue with some of those sites.
Yeah, the rich don't need anyone looking out for them, I don't think. They'll manage. It's clear, though, that you've got a passion for protecting nature. But alongside that, tied to it, is for citizen science, right? Which is it can be a contentious term. So community science, whatever you want to term it. Can you speak to the value of involving people in conservation? And I guess in the appreciation of nature more broadly, because it's an important thing, right?
Yeah, so like participatory science, community science, citizen science. We, especially during the pandemic, we witnessed a birth of so many new naturalists because of things like iNaturalist, Zooniverse, where teenagers, high school students, early college students became in love with nature because they could go run around outside and collect data on insects and plants. There's so many new naturalists now because of making data collection more easy, right? It's changed the game of science totally. Like we now have so much data available for analysis, for taxonomy, for ecology, for name your field of biology. Community science is now going to contribute immensely to a ton of different subfields. It's a really exciting time. And one of the most exciting things I think about community science is the social justice aspect of it, where people can now collect radioactivity information about their neighborhood as a result of the Fukushima, power plant. Or they could be in Detroit, Michigan, looking at collecting levels of lead in their drinking water and then bringing that to city council meetings and being like, what the heck is happening to my water? Right? So people can collect their own data now, can show their own results, and they can contribute to research like never before. And so in terms of plants and animals, so there's a project in Los Angeles called No Hills Canyon, whatever. So it's this place in the Verdugo Hills near Burbank, California, where a lot of your favorite TV shows are made, that they want to build a big housing development, and it's going to kill a lot of plants and animals. And there's tons of rare species there, that some of which are found nowhere else on Earth. And it makes no sense for yet another urban sprawl housing development. It's not building up. It's not building more skyscrapers with tons of multi-family housing. It's just single-family homes. It makes absolutely no sense. And people are using iNaturalist to collect data on moths, on nocturnal insects, on plants in the area, to demonstrate to the community, this is what you're going to lose if you build this housing development. So people are using community science to potentially stop the degradation of ecosystems. It is just, that's so amazing, right? And so with the count, it's much in the same vein, right? We can collect data on monarch butterflies to show cities, hey, if you remove these trees, which are giving ecosystem services to the community members that live by these trees, they're lowering the temperature, they're increasing evapotranspiration, they're providing shade, they're giving green spaces to people that might not otherwise have access to green spaces. We are showing the city, hey, this threatened species of butterfly is using this habitat. This is why you can't cut down these trees. So in a way, and in certain areas, it is a form of social justice. So again, I guess that LA is a really diverse place with a lot of diverse communities, rich and lower income. So it depends on where you're talking about. But community science has the potential to help us in our endeavors to be more equitable in how we treat people.
My next question for Richard was an odd one. Being an American, he is without a monarchy. Not the case myself. In my country, we've decided there's a specific family and that they are on a fundamental level more important than everyone else, and therefore they deserve our attention, our money, and our land. But for Richard, he's without monarch. I want to know, does the monarch butterfly, for him, deserve that title? Is it indeed a monarch among butterflies, with all that such a term would imply? His answer, though, fantastically, was not at all what I expected.
So aren't a lot of butterflies named after like some sort of royalty, like the viceroy, the monarch, yeah.
Emperor,
the
right?
Lord's admiral.
Good point.
Yeah, I think that's a vestige of British colonialism and kind of like
the Victorian
era, right? I kind of would love if what we did, what we're doing with birds right now, where we're like removing people from the bird common name.
Right. Okay.
I would love if we did that for. I'd love if we did that for plants and animals in general. Like, why do people need to be involved in a butterfly? The butterfly's, coloration is directly involved with its anti-predator response. A lot of other animals try to mimic it in being orange and black and try to, to imbue themselves with whatever reaction most animals have to that coloration, even if it's not an authentic disguise. Even if they're not toxic themselves, they still benefit from that coloration, as well as butterflies that are more bright they migrate better, which is super weird. So if the color of a monarch that eats tropical milkweed is a duller color, it's not as good at migrating. That connection between color and migration is something that it's so bizarre, but it warrants a lot of further research. But so not only are they strikingly beautiful, right? And they have this really silly name, but they're large. I think the North America's largest butterfly. That might be true. They might, or definitely the contiguous United States.
So how big are we talking? Not presumably a meter across.
Oh, so they definitely are like Dorito size. So if you're eating, a tortilla chip, it's kind of like two tortilla chips. I actually got retweeted by, not retweeted, they responded to me, Doritos, the company on Twitter, when because I used Doritos, I hot glued Doritos to a branch, and I used that in a training to train volunteers to count them. It was really fun, but Doritos actually responded on Twitter, and I like that was the peak of my scientific career. Like forget being on National Public Radio, like being responded to by a chip company was the pinnacle of my expertise. Anywho, so I was looking through your podcast, like all the speakers that you've had on before. And I think they would, a lot of your guests would probably agree that monarchs, unfortunately, get a huge percentage of the world's attention in terms of artistic representation, in terms of being in movies, in fashion. They're very charismatic. And as a plant person, I'm not very into charismatic organisms. I find that the things that are less charismatic are more interesting. I don't know if that's because I like being indie. I don't know why that is, but it's funny to me that I study something that's so charismatic and has captured so much of the cultural landscape of the world, right? I think a lot of other people are envious of that. They wish their organism was. I think the bee might be pretty close. I think native bee people are a little envious of the European honeybee for getting so much attention, but like there's very few other animals that have as much attention as the monarch butterfly. Maybe like the blue whale, maybe some whales, not all of them. The humpback whale, definitely. Elephants, lions, you know, they are, monarch butterflies are kind of up there with kind of the top tier animals. So, and it makes conservation easier, like, but it's not obviously it's not a panacea, right? Like, it is not, just because they're so charismatic is not helping monarch butterflies. It should, but it's not. Like, we are losing so much milkweed habitat. People are still chopping down their overwintering habitat, these eucalyptus trees and other native trees. Native trees, eucalyptus are not native, but people are applying pesticides on huge amounts of crops in the United States, and this is limiting milkweed habitat. Milkweed does great on those, like, in between farms, like on the sides of farms. That's up until the 1950s, butterflies were doing awesome because of that, because so many of the U.S. farms had milkweed just on the periphery of the farm itself. And now that we're using pesticides to the amount, the herbicides especially, that we're using, a lot of that milkweed habitat is just gone now. So we need to do more. We need to ban a lot of insecticides that are being used in the United States. We need to be very selective about herbicides and where we're using them and how we're using them. We need to be increasing the amount of milkweed that we're giving to people so that they can be planting milkweed in their backyards. We need to be protecting overwintering habitat and making really good laws that limit millionaires from destroying milkweed habitat. In Malibu especially, there's a lot of celebrities that live in Malibu, and I guarantee have eucalyptus in their tree, in their backyards, and they have overwintering habitat. And, like, we suspect Beyonce might have, like, one of the overwintering monarch habitat sites. But, like, how are we going to check on that? Like, we can't, like, go there and check on Beyonce's mansion. Right. But, like, at the same time, like, even with celebrities potentially being in the habitat of monarch butterflies. They are not charismatic enough to be saved. It's going to take a lot. Yeah, and like climate change, it's only getting worse. Like precipitation events are becoming more erratic in California. And last year we had a storm that wiped out a ton of monarchs mid-season, like in December. It killed a lot of monarchs. It also damaged a ton of homes, and it flooded most of Central California. It was a really bizarre event. And so with climate change, these events are going to become more and more common. I don't know what's going to happen. Like, you could be so charismatic that everyone recognizes you, but because you're an insect, but even like lions or elephants, like there's a limit to where charisma can take you. I don't know what the solution is, but it's definitely involved in the count and people learning more about the monarch and collecting data and getting involved in any way they can.
Well, perfect. Thank you so much. I do hope, I mean, if you're someone listening and you live in Bratislava, not a lot you can do to help, but I hope you've enjoyed learning about the monarch as I have, as someone equally who is unable to participate in the count. But if you are in a position to help out with the count, that sounds like a fantastic thing to do. Richard, thank you so much for spending your time and your expertise sharing the monarch with us, and thank you so much again.
Yeah, thanks so much. This was really fun.
Grubbing in the Filth was written and produced by me, Tom Sharp, with music by Will Hatton. And thanks again to Richard Rockman. You can find Grubbing in the Filth on Twitter at GITF Podcast or Instagram at Grubbing in the Filth. You can also email grubbinginthefilth@gmail.com. Thank you.